And joining us on the phone is our first guest, Dr. Timothy Davis. He's an expert in plankton ecology. He's an associate professor at the Department of Biological Sciences at Bowling Green State University. And he's here to talk about what's going on in Florida right now with respect to two types of algae, if I understand this correctly. There's blue-green algae, and then there's red tide. First of all, Dr. Davis, thank you for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. So let's start with red tide. This seems to be the more menacing of the two. Both are bad. let's just get some background. We're familiar with out here with blue-green algae because we have our own algae problems, and cyanobacteria like that is showing up in bodies of water out here. That's a freshwater type algae. Red tide seems to be more saltwater-based. Is that correct?
That's correct. Red tide is the way that we generate these names, red tide, brown tide, you know, what they call the blue-green tide, is based on the type of pigments that they can produce. So the red tide is primarily composed of a dinoflagellate called Karenia brevis. And the reason why this is an issue and has been an issue in Florida, especially on the Gulf side, is because it can produce a compound known as brevetoxin, which is a neurotoxin. And that's what has been leading to these deaths in marine life, from fish all the way up to what they think are they're linking it to sea turtle deaths, possibly even a whale shark. So these are very potent neurotoxins, especially when these types of events occur and these algae bloom to levels where the toxin concentration gets so high that they can be lethal very, very quickly.
Let's talk a little bit about the conditions, I guess, that set the scene for red tide. What kind of causes this to happen?
Well, most of these algal blooms are due to having the right light, temperature, and nutrients, right? So red tide, for example, generally occurs around this time of year. It, again, algae are just microscopic plants, so you need to have the three things that plants need: light, temperature, the right temperature, enough light, and enough nutrients for them to grow. And, you know, that those conditions vary from year to year, which is why you see differences in bloom size and duration from year to year. But what we do know is that climate change does seem to be impacting these events, you know, especially in the freshwater environments we can get to, obviously, a little bit. But during this time of the year, when the waters are warmer and you have enough nutrients, the red tide algae, the Karenia brevis, tends to grow very well and tends to dominate the community. And that's why you see these waters turn blood red.
Okay.
And are these nutrients that you talk about naturally occurring nutrients that you'd find in the ocean, or are these excess nutrients that are coming from the human sources we worry about, fertilizer or sewage or things like that?
Sure, that's a great question. You know, nutrients are found naturally in the environment. They're needed. They help sustain healthy food webs because, you know, plankton are the base of most aquatic food webs, and they're extremely important. But it's when you get, like what you said, the excess nutrients that allow these blooms to occur, and that's generally due to human influence, whether it's from point sources such as wastewater treatment plants, non-point source runoff from agricultural fields. In that region, it tends to be more point source driven. So wastewater treatment plants, sewage, etc., and that, not raw sewage, obviously, but the effluent from wastewater treatment plants still has nutrients.
So how deep does red tide extend? I've read that, of course, among all the fish that have been killed, this includes some surprising species. I think are somewhat surprising. Goliath grouper. These are some of the largest grouper or sea bass types of sea bass, but they usually hang around in deeper, what I think are deeper waters. Does red tide have a vertical extent?
Sure. So one of the really cool things about diatoms is that they're actually motile to a certain extent. So they have a flagella that they can use to move and to a certain degree dictate where they are on the water column. The other thing is, you know, because they're plankton, and the definition of plankton is that they don't have the general ability to swim against currents or mixing, is that it depends on physical conditions of the system. So not just the not just their ability to move, but also how much wind is there, right? Are they being mixed down to the bottom where they can get ingested or and impact these fish from, you know, that swim in the water column near the surface all the way down to what you're saying, grouper, that mainly live towards the bottom. So it all depends, again, on physical characteristics of the system at that time, how much wind, how much mixing is there, and also where are they? Because one of, obviously, things like to survive, they like to live. So one of the methods that they use is that they can have what we call diel, or daily vertical migration, where they can potentially move down in the water column at night, when the zooplankton, who tend to stay out of the surface waters during the day, because if zooplankton can be seen, then they can be eaten. So they tend to hide down at depth during the day, and then they come up at night to feed. Well, the algae have developed a defense against this, and they do the exact opposite. So there are two modes of which they can move throughout the water column. One is self-propelled, and the other is just due to wind mixing.
Okay. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Timothy. Hold on, Dr. Davis. I got to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Dr. Timothy Davis. He is an associate professor at the Department of Biological Sciences of Bowling Green State University. We're talking about both the red tide and blue-green algae outbreaks that Florida is experiencing. Is this, you say that red tide occurs, you know, not unsurprisingly, each year to some degree or not. Is this year particularly bad?
It seems to be. We're kind of in the middle of it. So that is, in terms of its impact to wildlife and potentially human health, yes, this year does seem to be a bit worse than it has been in the past few years. But, you know, for us to say better or worse, we really need to take a long-term view, and that's not data that I have right in front of me, but for all intents and purposes, what we're seeing right now, absolutely. I mean, this is a major bloom that's occurring, and one that seems to be very toxic and seems to be impacting a lot of wildlife. So, yes, the short answer is yes. It does seem to be worse than the past few years in terms of its impact. Whether or not this is a trend still remains to be seen, or if this is an outlier or a spike in a slower progressing trend of increasing bloom severity. That's something that, you know, only time will tell.
Let's talk a little bit about the human impacts you referenced. You know, I think a lot of the focus has been on wildlife, of course, because we're seeing these heartbreaking pictures of, you know, manatees or otters or whatever.
Turtles.
But there is a risk to humans as well, right?
They definitely are a risk to humans. One of the ways in which they're a risk and have been a risk for a long time is that these toxins can become aerosolized, which means they can, you know, as wind creates waves and waves splash, these little water droplets can be propelled through the air and actually have impacts further in inland than the beach. And this is important because, you know, ingesting these toxins or breathing them in can cause asthma-like symptoms. Mm. And it's especially bad for people that have asthma. And one of the reasons, well, there's multiple reasons why that's bad, but this has led to, you know, people having to sell their houses, to move further inland, to stop coming to these certain areas to vacation, which right. has economic ramifications in the in these areas. So it goes from a human health threat to a human health impact, and that human health impact ultimately impacts the economy of these regions. Now, the one way in which we are not necessarily as threatened as the marine life is that, one, we are aware that these blooms are occurring and can avoid them to a certain extent, where the marine life is unaware that they're occurring and they're just living out their daily lives and having to come in contact with these blooms or their toxins. So we can avoid these areas. We can avoid going to the beach. But then again, that goes back into the economic impacts where, you know, it's middle of summer. It's prime vacation season for many people. And if they're avoiding these areas, then right. that's hurting the economy of these areas.
Right. I read a small story about how one business, a stand-up paddleboard rental business, kayak business, had to lay off some people because their business is effectively shut down during this time and will continue to be. And that's my question here is, like, how long might this last? When does the tide shut down or shut off?
That is a great question. I can't predict that. Yeah. It varies from year to year. So unfortunately, I wish I had a magic eight ball that could say, hey, in 2 weeks, it's going to be gone. But that's
But it is a function.
A much more dynamic question.
But it, obviously, it'll be a function of, among other things, water temperature, say weather patterns changing, cooler conditions,
yes.
and less nutrients being introduced into the Gulf.
So yes, and if you're talking about, are you talking the short term? When is this bloom going to go away this year, or when are these blooms going to go? When are these blooms going to stop occurring?
No,
right. So there's a short term.
Yes, short term.
Okay, so yes, it depends on those three factors: so nutrient depletion, cooling water temperatures, and if there is a big storm that comes through, that could break up the bloom. If you have a decent summer storm that comes through and you know, pushes the bloom, disrupts the conditions where these cells like to grow for a long enough period of time, that could end the bloom or significantly reduce it to where it's no longer a threat. Will that happen? Will a storm like that happen is anyone's guess.
Right.
When will the water cool? That all depends on, a number of factors. At least in the part of the region where I live in Ohio, we had an early heat wave. So our blooms in Lake Erie kicked up, almost 2 weeks earlier than normal.
Wow.
So nobody really saw that coming, but it happened.
Right. Right. Okay. So I thought we got a few more minutes. Let's turn our attention to the blue-green algae, the cyanobacteria-based algae. What is the source and impacts associated with that outbreak?
Okay, well, we have these, the red tides obviously are, that marine-based, but these blue-green algae, these blooms are originating in a system named Lake Okeechobee, mm-hmm. right, the largest water body in Florida. And what happens is that water body is regulated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for water height, because if the water gets too high, it will impact, it will blow a dike, which, will send water throughout Southeast Florida. That's not a good thing. So they have to maintain water levels at a safe height. When they do that and there's a bloom occurring, because Lake Okeechobee is essentially the catchment lake for all of the citrus crop, sugarcane crop that's growing in Florida, the nutrients just like we have here, different crops, but again, agriculturally based nutrient input into Lake Okeechobee fuels these blooms. And then these blooms grow and develop. So when the Army Corps has to release water to maintain the integrity of the dike, that's when they flush down the St. Lucie River to the east and the Caloosahatchee River to the west. And when that happens, you have essentially a large blue-green algal bloom being flushed down into the estuary, and sometimes can even expand out the inlet and end up along the Atlantic Coast beaches. And at least that's what happened in 2016.
Right.
So you have this freshwater bloom occurring in Lake Okeechobee that gets flushed down and impacts regions from the lake all the way to the estuary. And depending on when these blooms occur, again, can have major economic impacts to that region.
Right. So is blue-green, does that emit a neurotoxin, or is that more of an oxygen depletion type of situation that has harmful impacts to marine life?
Sure. So the blooms in Lake Okeechobee, we've been able to detect the potential to produce two toxins. One is microcystin. It's the same toxin that occurs in Lake Erie and caused the Toledo water shutdown of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hepatotoxin. It's a liver toxin. There's also what we found is the genetic capability to produce saxitoxin. And saxitoxin is more commonly known as paralytic shellfish poison. That's a neurotoxin. So there are two types of toxins that are produced by this bloom. Microcystins are by far the dominant toxin that's produced during this bloom. And again, that's more of a liver toxin. So it's not just low oxygen, but low oxygen events can occur when these blooms die because you have such high biomass that when it dies, the bacteria kind of chew up all that organic matter. They suck up all the oxygen, and it can cause fish kills in certain systems. So it's a multifaceted impact to both the environment as well as human health. But the human health impacts are much different than what we see in the red tide.
Right.
Is it possible to diagnose, not only with humans, but with the wildlife, to understand what it is that's causing their death, whether it's the red tide or the blue-green algae, the microcystin, you know.
Plastic in their stomach.
Yeah. Is it possible to tell?
Parse that out.
What's causing a death or an illness?
So what is causing the death in the marine life?
Yeah.
So that is hepatotoxin. So these microcystins have been shown to cause death in marine mammals. So we do have that freshwater to marine lake, but in this case, the blooms are not expanding, and the toxins, it would be highly unlikely that these freshwater toxins are impacting the marine life.
Okay.
The marine life are coming in contact with that red tide, and it's much more probable that the red tide is to blame for the marine mammal and marine organism death than the blue-green algae. In this case, there are other cases where we do see these microcystins. This is out in California, that they get flushed out into an estuary. They get ingested by clams, which are filter feeders. The toxins get concentrated in the clams, and then you have marine mammals like these southern sea otters and other types of marine organisms that eat the clams and can end up dying. But that does not look like it's the case in Florida. It looks like it's the red tide that is the culprit in these marine deaths in this specific instance.
Hmm. But I'm going to assume that birds are at risk if they're feeding on these fish that are either dead or dying. All right, aren't they also ingesting these neurotoxins or microtoxins?
They could be, yes. So it's more the neurotoxin. It depends on if the neurotoxin is bioaccumulating in the fish that they're eating. So it depends on how the mode of action in terms of the neurotoxin is occurring. That is that's a bioaccumulation question, and I don't have a lot of good information on that.
Okay.
But when it comes to birds being at risk, well, you have other issues that you have to think about, even aside from the toxin that's being produced by the by these HABs that are potentially killing the fish. But then you also have other bacteria that are associated with dead and decaying fish that if a bird ingests that, that could also be another mode of exposure to a potential toxin or to a potentially lethal organism, right? So it's a sweet, it's somewhat complicated because it's almost a cat, it's linking these deaths in the fish to potential risk to birds.
Right.
It could be a multifaceted risk. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay. We have to wrap up. In any case, this is probably one of the worst outbreaks for decades. That's occurred in decades. And I will make the statement. I know you're very careful, cautious about it. But to me, having lived in Florida for 14 years and then moving out here, this is the worst I've ever seen it. And from my friends who still live there and talk to it, this is the worst they've ever seen it. And I will say that on a long term, this is climate change showing up, showing itself. These are the predictions we made perhaps maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago, that if the Gulf waters continued to warm and we didn't do enough about nutrient overloads coming out of Lake Okeechobee, this is what was going to happen. And this is what's happening now. This is the impact and the consequences of it. That's my little editorial on that, Dr. Davis. But I see this as just as an ongoing trend with as waters stay warm. Go ahead.
And I believe the science agrees with that in many instances, especially a lot of the climate change, because climate change can impact these, at least the freshwater blooms, in two ways. One, cyanobacteria really like warm water.
Right.
And they also like lots of nutrients. And depending on where you are in the country, climate change is not only, you know, linked to increasing, you know, air and water temperature, but also changes in precipitation patterns. And when you look at the nutrient input into these systems, especially from agricultural-dominated areas, it's all precipitation-based.
Mm.
So the more rain you have, the more nutrients. The warmer the water you have, the better these cyanobacteria grow. So you're kind of combining two pillars of what cyanobacteria need to grow. And the third pillar is sunlight, and that sunlight isn't going anywhere.
Right.
So we do anticipate, and all the science predicts that blooms, that both coastal and freshwater blooms, are potentially going to become more frequent, last longer, be more dense, and in the case of at least freshwater blooms, potentially become more toxic. So this climate change is definitely playing a factor and will continue to play a factor into the future. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. We'll end it on that. Dr. Timothy Davis, he's an associate professor of plankton ecology, among other things, at the Department of Biological Sciences at Bowling Green State University. Dr. Davis, do you have a blog, shameless plug, that you'd like to give for people to learn more about the work you do on plankton ecology?
Well, I would just say you can visit Bowling Green State University's website. We are the lead institution in a federally funded Center for Fresh Waters and Human Health, which studies the impact of harmful algal blooms, especially from freshwater environments, on human health. So we're excited about that five-year program, and that's a program that involves seven of the leading institutions that study freshwater harmful algal blooms in the country.
Well, it sounds like a program that's got that has a lot of work in front of it.
Plenty of work to do.
Yeah. So we'll stay.
There's no shortage.
Yes, exactly. We'll stay in touch, Dr. Davis. Thank you again for joining us on This Green Earth.